Thank you for choosing to take a self-guided, GPS-enabled audio tour with Free Tours by Foot. We believe in operating quality tours that are affordable to everybody, regardless of their budget, and we hope that you enjoy your tour with us today. You've chosen to come along on our London Rock and Roll Walking Tour. London has long been the epicenter of the rock and roll world, and this nostalgic tour will take you on a journey through performances, recordings, album covers, and legendary gigs, both firsts and lasts. You'll get the behind-the-scenes stories of infamous nights out, lives, loves, and the tragedies and triumphs of some of music's iconic legends. On the tour today, you can expect to walk just over 2 miles or 3 kilometers. The tour will last, on average, around 2.5 hours, although this may change depending on your walking pace or stops you wish to make along the way. For guests with mobility issues, or those with prams or buggies, there are no steps on the route, but there are cobbled streets to take into consideration. The self-guided, GPS-enabled rock and roll walking tour begins near Piccadilly Circus Underground Station, next to the Shaftesbury Memorial Fountain, more commonly known as the Statue of Eros. Stand underneath the statue's bow, with your back to the junction, boots, and the huge advertising lights. You will have Piccadilly to your right, and you'll be facing down Regent Street, St. James. This is the street you want to walk down. Take the first right onto Jermyn Street. Walk until you get to Duke of York Street. Here, take a left, and then the first right into Ormond Yard. Walk until Ormond Yard dead ends, and take the path to your left, then follow it around to the right. This will bring you out onto Mason's Yard, your first stop. This is the incredible Mason's Yard, a quiet haven just a few moments away from the busiest streets in town. There are two buildings in this yard that are important to us on our walk today. The first is the Art Gallery at No. 6. This is the Stephen Ongpin and Guy Pepiat Art Gallery, but in 1966, this was the Indica Art Gallery, which was co-owned by Paul McCartney and a man called Peter Asher. Asher was the brother of a beautiful British model and actress called Jane Asher, who was, at the time, Paul McCartney's first serious girlfriend. Now, in 1966, Paul McCartney was already world-famous and exceptionally wealthy. Paul was great with money and had invested quite a lot of it, and at this point in his life was going through, let's just say, a bit of an artistic phase. LSD was quite popular at this point in time, and had decided to invest money with Peter in this art gallery. On the 7th of November, 1966, John and Peter were hosting the opening of a new exhibition called The Art of Unfinished Paintings and Objects. The artist was an up-and-coming Japanese artist called Yoko Ono. Yoko was a rather quirky artist. A lot of her exhibits involved human interaction, and guests were invited to take part by paying the small fee of 5 shillings upon entering the gallery. On this night, her exhibition involved a ladder in the center of the gallery that guests were invited to climb, and, when at the top, then told to hammer a nail into the roof of the building. On the guest list that evening, of course, was John Lennon. There was a lot of buzz and excitement at the gallery in preparation for his arrival, but Yoko Ono wasn't bothered at all. When John arrived, he decided he liked the look of the exhibit and climbed up the ladder. Yoko spotted him, walked over, and asked for the 5 shillings. John told Yoko he would give her an imaginary 5 shillings, hammer in an imaginary nail, and then they would be even. This is the oft-recorded version of their first meeting, but it is worth remembering they did not end up together that night. Although their attraction was obvious and instantaneous, it would be another year or so before they would meet again and become a couple. Now turn your attention to number 13, the Scotch of St. James. Let's stay in the year 1966. The top two biggest bands in the world are the Beatles and the Rolling Stones. The members of these bands cannot go outside their front doors without being mobbed by the public. And you've all seen the footage. Screaming and fainting girls, rushing crowds, people jumping on top of cars. For these celebrities, there is no peace to be found anywhere. To combat this, the rock stars and their friends have begun operating a series of exclusive, private, members-only clubs, like the Scotch of St. James. The only way to get through the doors here was to be exceptionally famous, instantly recognizable, and your name had to be on the list. Most of the club doors had smaller sliding doors, or hidey holes like you can see here, where guests could whisper in a password. On entrance, visitors would be surrounded by the creme de la creme of swinging 60s society. And there was only one rule. What happened in the club stayed in the club. For many of the world's biggest rock stars, this was their only slice of privacy. Here, they wouldn't need to worry about press intrusion, public mobs, or constantly being watched, and with a capacity of only about 80 people, it still maintained a sense of intimacy. However, this doesn't make our job to tell you what happened here very easy. We have very little idea about what exactly went on behind closed doors in the exclusive clubs, but we do have a couple of verified stories, such as the one involving Chaz Chandler. Chaz was the bass player with the Animals. You may be familiar with their most famous hit, The House of the Rising Sun. The Animals were doing well, but they were nowhere near in the same financial or popularity bracket as the Beatles or the Stones. Chaz decided he wanted to use the contacts that he'd made in the recording industry to become a music agent, talent scout, and record producer. He wanted to find a couple of acts, get them on stage, make them famous, and make himself some money. Having searched around London, Chaz didn't see anything he liked, so he decided to fly to New York City, where he would strike absolute gold. Chaz came across a black American guitarist playing incredible rock music, and his name, of course, was James Marshall Hendrix, or, as history would know him, Jimi Hendrix. At this point in Jimmy's life, things were not going so well. The American public didn't understand a black artist playing rock and roll music. They were more inclined to listen to black artists playing soul, Motown, and jazz. Chaz approached Jimmy and suggested that perhaps across the Atlantic in London, his music would be more popularly received. Having nothing to lose, Jimi Hendrix traveled back to the UK with Chaz, and back to here, to the Scotch of St. James in Mason's Yard. If you can imagine it, it's the night of the 24th of September, 1966, and on stage in the Scotch is Eric Clapton and Cream. At this point, Eric was the coolest, most famous guitarist in the entire world, and the crowd in the Scotch were loving it. When he took a break, Chaz approached Eric and told him he just brought over a young musician from the States and asked if there was any way that this artist could join Eric on stage and just have a little jam, introduce him to the crowd and see how it goes. And Eric said sure. So Jimmy gets on stage and does what he always did. He blows the crowd away. He's playing with his teeth, he's holding the guitar behind his head, Mick Jagger is in the front row cheering, Pete Townsend was there, Ike and Tina Turner in the audience. After three songs, Eric Clapton walked off stage and came out here into Mason's Yard to furiously smoke a cigarette. Somebody asked him where he was going, and Eric replied, "I'm going home to practice." Today, the Scotch still operates, and it is still exclusive. Metallica has partied here, and more recently, Rihanna had a birthday party inside. Although we've never been invited inside the club, one of our guys did manage to sneak in one day while the club was undergoing some restoration, and she was able to snap an incredibly remarkable photo of the hallway where you first walk in. We'll include this photo so you can see it too. It's a list of all the legends that have ever played here. This is the beauty of rock and roll in London. These small, quiet spaces are filled with history you can't even imagine. Just here, John met Yoko, and Jimi Hendrix introduced himself to the music world, changing the course of rock and roll history forever. With your back to the Scotch and the gallery on your right, walk straight ahead, then go left around the building in the middle of the square, and take the first right out of Mason's Yard. Then, make the first right into Duke Street, St. James. Cross over German Street, and continue walking with Fortnum and Mason on your right. When you get to Piccadilly, cross the street and turn left. Keep the Royal Academy of Arts on your right, and then make a right into Burlington Arcade. Play the next clip as you walk. This is the stunning Burlington Arcade, a 19th century precursor to the modern shopping mall. Built in the year 1818 on the order of George Cavendish, the first Earl of Burlington, it was designed by architect Samuel Ware. Since its construction, the arcade has been patrolled by uniformed Beatles, with a D. When the arcade first opened, the rooms above were occupied by prostitutes, who would keep a lookout below on behalf of the pickpockets that would lurk in the area. If there were any sign of a Beatle or a police officer, the prostitutes would whistle so the pickpockets could get out of the area. Owing to this, a ban was placed on whistling in the arcade. This ban remained in full effect until one day in the 1980s, when a male shopper was looking into one of the windows and began to absentmindedly whistle. A passing beetle cleared his throat and began to tell the man about the whistling rule. When the man turned around to apologize, however, the beetle was shocked to see that it was none other than Paul McCartney. The uniformed beetle told the beetle that he would be given a lifetime exemption of the rule, and Paul became the only person permitted to whistle in the arcade. Reportedly, to this day, whenever he happens to be strolling this way, he takes full usage of his exemption and whistles while he walks. When you come out of the arcade, turn right onto Burlington Gardens and walk until you get to Savile Row. Turn left here and stop almost immediately at number 3. We are now standing on Savile Row, the most expensive and exclusive tailoring street in the entire world. For those of you wanting to do a bit of shopping, a custom tailored suit here at the very least will set you back around £15,000. The royal family shops here, celebrities getting dressed for the Oscars come here, and so did the Beatles. Number 3 Savile Row is now surprisingly owned by Abercrombie & Fitch, but was previously the Apple Studios, the recording studio where the Beatles laid down some of their most iconic tracks outside of Abbey Road. Now imagine it's 1969. The Beatles are not getting along. It's all falling apart. John and Yoko are on the scene, there's a big division in the band, and the Let It Be film is about to be released. The Beatles are wanting to create something new, some new live footage to insert into their film. They want something that has never been seen before, and they don't want to go into the archives. They want to create. So on the 30th of January, 1969, all 4 Beatles got on the roof of this very building and performed an impromptu, live, open-air concert here in the center of London. What was unknown to the Beatles and the public that day was that this would be the very last time all 4 of the Beatles would ever play together. To see the exact spot this concert took place, look to the top 2 floors of number 3. You can see some white paneling on the side of the building, 2 floors down from the current rooftop. These additional 2 floors were added later. Back in 1969, this building had a flat roof, so the Beatles concert took place right where that white paneling is now. Now, take a look at the building on the opposite side of the street with the red letterbox out front. It's likely that the 30th of January 1969 started off as a regular boring work day for everybody in this neighborhood, but that was soon to change. Inside this building, which housed a bank at the time, was a member of staff based on the top floor having his lunch, who looked out his window to see the most famous rock band in the entire world performing a concert right opposite his office. He's got a front row view, the best seat in the house. Everybody on the planet would have been ecstatic to be here, except for this particular gentleman who decided he was going to ring the police to complain about the noise. So the police have to act on this complaint, and they call Apple Studios to tell the Beatles that they're going to have to stop playing. The Beatles say, sure, no problem, and they'll stop immediately, but they actually had no plans on doing that whatsoever. After a while, the police called back and said if they didn't stop playing, they were going to get arrested. At this point, in 1969, the members of the Beatles had all been arrested multiple times for various crimes and misdemeanors, so the threat didn't mean too much to them. In fact, they thought getting arrested would make great footage for their movie, so they kept playing. At this point, there were huge crowds outside, and people were even trying to climb the drain pipes to get onto the rooftop with the stars. The police called back for the third time, and this time they cut the power to the building, ending the concert. All in all, the Beatles racked up 42 minutes of spectacular footage of their impromptu gig, and a lot of this footage is available on YouTube for you to watch and bring the incident back to life. As you can imagine, this location has become like Mecca to Beatles fans throughout the world who want to come and witness the spot of the Fab Four's final performance. In fact, the door to number 3 has been replaced 4 times, as fans have previously destroyed them by leaving their messages to the band. The doors themselves have lived on, however. 3 of the 4 Beatles owned a number 3 Savile Row door. Paul is the only one without one. In fact, John and Yoko had theirs installed in the Dakota Building in New York City. Now, as you might imagine, Savile Row is a posh spot for posh shops, and many of the business owners here were very upset that their street became home to the Apple Studios, bringing in hippies and rock and roll fans from across the globe. But one of them cleverly decided to capitalize on the street's newfound fame. His name was Tommy Nutter. Tommy shook up Savile Row in the 50s, 60s, and 70s with his handcrafted avant-garde designs that he created in his shop here at number 12. He figured that the Beatles were multimillionaires, so why not make suits for them? He made suits for them all, as well as flamboyant suits for Elton John, tailored the iconic pantsuit Twiggy wore for the first time, and tailored for The Who and made leather trousers for Mick Jagger. He also made the suit John Lennon would wear for his marriage to Yoko Ono. But above all else, Tommy was the tailor who made 3 out of the 4 suits worn by the Beatles on the front of the iconic Abbey Road album. 2016 was a rough year for music fans, seeing the passing of numerous iconic musicians, Leonard Cohen, Merle Haggard, Glenn Frey, Prince, George Michael, and David Bowie. Bowie's death shocked London. Nobody knew he was sick. He knew himself, as we can now see from his album Black Star and the single Lazarus, where he wrote about his illness. Londoners mourned the passing of Bowie, and many of them did so here. But why? Think about Bowie in happier times, when he was shocking Londoners not by his passing, but by his flamboyant, groundbreaking music and fashion. When Ziggy Stardust fell to earth, nobody knew it hit them. And it was here that Bowie set the scene for the iconic cover of the Ziggy Stardust and the Spiders from Mars album. Just around the corner, we will face the doorway that Bowie was leaning against on that album cover. And this is where many Londoners came to pay tribute to Bowie when he died. Hundreds of people came here. Photographers were around. The press was on the scene. The bars and restaurants on the street were blasting out his music. It was an emotional scene of loss and celebration. Although David Bowie was from Brixton in South London, and there would be thousands of mourners there, Ziggy Stardust's darkened doorway became a focal point for the emotional outpouring of fans from across the globe. And there is one other image of Ziggy Stardust on the inside sleeve of the Spiders from Mars album. That of Bowie inside an iconic London red telephone box. That phone box is here in this alleyway and serves as a somewhat unusual tribute to Bowie. You will notice there are many messages and signatures from fans that have been drawn on and scratched into the frame and windows of this box. Take the opportunity here to see the telephone box and maybe pose for a photo yourself. Facing the phone box, with your back to the entrance of Heddon Street, turn to the left and stop at number 23 on your right. This is it, the doorway that Bowie posed on for that infamous album cover. The event is marked here with a London Blue plaque. The London Blue plaque scheme began in 1866 and has since seen over 900 plaques placed on buildings in London, commemorating the men and women who lived and worked inside. Since then, many organizations have started their own plaque commemorations, some dedicated to single issues such as musicians or scientists, and others for pop culture. And there are three London plaques dedicated to fictional people, including the one you're looking at now. Who has the other two? Pause here and see if you can guess. Have you got it? Sherlock Holmes on Baker Street and Paddington Bear at Paddington Station. Now, leave Heddon Street the way you came in. When you get to Regent Street, turn left. When you get back to the junction with New Burlington Street, cross to the other side of the street. Turn left, then take the immediate first right onto Tennyson Court. Walk until it dead ends at number 9 Kingly Street. The Bag of Nails. The name of the club is taken from the old Roman word bacchanal, meaning wild and drunken debauchery. Reigned as the most popular club in London for decades. This club was a London institution in the international music scene. This was another exclusive London club like we saw before, the kind where you could only get in if your name was on the list, and numerous famous incidents and gigs have taken place inside. Georgie Fame was on stage here one night, and Paul McCartney, his friend, was in the audience to watch. Paul had just been dumped by his girlfriend Jane Asher and had come here to drink away his sorrows. After a while, the doors to the Bag of Nails opened, and the beautiful American photojournalist Linda Eastman, who'd come to London to photograph Georgie Fame, walked in. So it was here that Paul first met Linda, an incident commemorated with a plaque you can see in the doorway. Another night at the Bag of Nails saw the debut performance of what would become a legendary band. Chaz Chandler, busy promoting his discovery of Jimi Hendrix, who we earlier heard was playing gigs at the Scotch of St. James, had sold 9 of Hendrix's guitars to get enough money to put on a debut show here at the club. This show became the very first gig played by the Jimi Hendrix Experience, also marked by a plaque in the door. The Bag of Nails is also rumored to be the location where John and Christine McVie met, who would later go on to found Fleetwood Mac. Sadly, although this is the original building, the Bag of Nails is no more and has since been taken over by a bar. Facing the Bag of Nails, turn left and take the first right into Kingly Court. Walk straight through until you come out onto Carnaby Street and turn right. Stop when you get to number 7. This is the infamous Carnaby Street. Still a hotspot for shopping and nightlife, but only a shadow of its former self as a central location for London's swinging 60s and outrageous 70s. This is where Mary Quant debuted the miniskirt, where The Who socialized and recorded Quadrophenia, where Paul Wells and The Jam hung out, where the Sex Pistols got together and along with The Clash and The Stranglers created the British punk scene. This is where the rivalry between the Mods and the Skinheads played out and the Who's Who of London society came to party. But what happened? Gentrification. The storefronts and pubs and clubs were all slowly bought and taken over by high price and popular fashion brands and chain stores. Soho used to be the hub of sex, drugs, tattoos, and rock and roll in London before CCTV cameras were installed, forcing the neighborhood's traditional pastimes to go underground. London is home to over 300,000 CCTV cameras, more than any other city in the world, which means the streets of Soho went from the home of counterculture and fun-loving freedom while partying until all hours of the night to homogeneity and bars closing at 11 p.m. Now, that's not to say that Soho's traditional activities no longer take place here. In fact, one need not walk far to get a tattoo or visit a massage parlor. It's just that it's a little harder to find. We've included some photos here of Carnaby back in its heyday for you to enjoy. Across the street from where you are standing is numbers 52 to 55, and this was the office of a man called Don Arden, nicknamed Mr. Big, the most successful music agent in 60s and 70s London. He represented an army of huge stars and bands like Jerry Lee Lewis, Little Richard, Air Supply, Small Faces, The Move, and ELO. Don had a horrendously ferocious reputation and was known for his aggressive and oftentimes illegal business tactics. There are numerous stories of his thuggish behavior, and he is known to have even gone so far as to hang a rival musical agent by their ankles over the edge of the building because he suspected them of trying to steal one of his clients. Now, in 1974, there was a rock band that were experiencing some success in the US and the UK and were looking for a new manager. Everybody on both sides of the Atlantic knew that Don Arden was the agent to have if you wanted your band to be successful, so this is where they came. Don worked his magic, and this group would go on to essentially found the heavy metal industry. However, drugs and alcohol were rampant, not just in Soho, on the music scene in the 70s, and by 1979 the lead singer was fired by Don for his inability to keep sober. Around this time, Don had decided to allow his two children to work for him, with the idea of handing down his legacy. His daughter Sharon seemed to be following in his footsteps, but eventually she got on the wrong side of her father by deciding to represent the fired lead singer and manage his solo career, which took off like a rocket. Reportedly, when her father found out Sharon was managing and dating an artist that he had fired, he allowed his vicious dogs to savage her when she came to visit him, and afterwards didn't speak to her for 20 years. So what was this band, and who was this singer? The band was Black Sabbath, and the singer, Ozzy Osbourne. Today, Don's daughter Sharon is known the world over by her married name, and she rightfully claims the credit for making Ozzy the star that he became. Today, there's a plaque dedicated to Don Arden right here on the site of his former offices. With boots on your right, walk back up Carnaby Street and take the first right onto Broadwick Street and the mural. This is the Spirit of Soho mural, put together by a group of amateur artists in the 1990s. The image reflects what Soho is all about, a cool, bohemian neighborhood, the stomping grounds of some of the world's most recognizable names and faces. Beatles fans will notice that the mural was heavily inspired by the cover of the Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band album, and all the people you see up there, and this is an eclectic group of people dating from the 15th century up to today, all have one thing in common. They all at one time or another lived here in Soho. Now behind you, near the ATM, is a legend you can look at to see who's who. We've also included a photo of it here. The mural represents different aspects of the spirit of Soho, and if you look at the bottom right rectangle, you will see an image representing Ronnie Scott. Ronnie himself is depicted here, playing the saxophone. Ronnie was one of the most famous jazz musicians in the world, and it was he who played the saxophone on the Beatles track Lady Madonna, completely transforming the song. We'll be visiting his club in a bit. The man in the back in the pinstripe suit on the same panel is the iconic jazz singer, George Melly. In the center, there are four figures around the clock, including Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart in yellow, perhaps the world's first rock star. Mozart actually wrote his first symphony, K-16, here in London. At the time, he was on a tour through Europe and was staying in Belgravia with his family before moving on to the Chelsea area. Mozart would come back to London later in life and stay here in Soho. I'll show you where he lived later in the tour. He stands next to Karl Marx, who wrote the majority of his Communist Manifesto here in Soho. Next to him is Teresa Cornelis, an Italian opera singer who's standing beside her lover, depicted to her left, the notorious Lothario Casanova, no doubt fleeing persecution from husbands all over mainland Europe. Now, if you happen to be here on the hour, you'll see something truly bizarre and magnificent. Every hour, on the hour, A can of Coca-Cola appears from behind Das Kapital, and Karl Marx takes a sip. Teresa winks at Casanova, and he attempts to kiss her. With the mural on your right, continue down Broadwick Street until you see Berwick Street on your right. As you stand at the top of Berwick Street, take a look down. Depending on whether the market is running or not, you may recognize a street from the cover of Oasis's album What's the Story, Morning Glory. If you want to recreate the cover of the album for yourself, head down the road to number 36 to get right where the band posed for their cover photo. With Berwick Street on your right, continue forward on Broadwick Street. Stop when you get to Duck Lane on your right. Today, this building on the corner, Sounds of the Universe, is a record store. But back in 1962, this was a pub known as the Bricklayer's Arms. And at the top floor of this very building is where the auditions were held for one of the greatest rock and roll bands in the entire world, the Rolling Stones. In 1961, Mick Jagger was studying at the London School of Economics, training to become an accountant, when he happened to bump into Keith Richards, who he had actually attended primary school with, on a train platform, reintroducing them into one another's lives, and changing the shape of rock and roll history forever. Jagger was carrying some records under his arm which sparked Richards' interests. The two got to talking and eventually decided to play some music together. They formed a small band, met with other small bands, and jammed together throughout the next few months. One of the musicians they came into contact with was a guitarist called Brian Jones, and Brian was the one that would make it all happen. Brian decided he wanted to form a new R&B group, so he placed an ad in the May 2nd, 1962 issue of a magazine called Jazz News, advertising auditions for a new band to be held at the Bricklayer's Arms in Soho. Ian Stewart, the Stones' original pianist, was the first to reply to this ad. Later, Mick auditioned and was accepted immediately as the frontman. Whatever it is, Jagger had it in abundance, and Jones saw that straight away. Not long after, Mick invited Keith to come along with him to play some guitar during one of their early rehearsals. Brian loved Keith's sound and invited him to join the band as well. It was around this time that the band's name also came into existence. According to Richards, one day Jones was on the phone with a journalist who was conducting an interview for Jazz News. When the journalist asked Jones what the name of his new group was, Brian realized they hadn't yet settled on one. He happened to glance at the back of a Best of Muddy Waters album that was near the phone and spotted the title of one of their tracks, Rolling Stone, and thus the name was born. As for Bill Wyman, he joined in December 1962 and was invited into the band because he always shared his cigarettes and he always had a spare amplifier. Drummer Charlie Watts was the last to join. He had known the group on the jazz and blues circuit and they finally convinced him to come on board with them in early 1963, thus completing the lineup of the legendary Rolling Stones. And it all began right here. Sadly, Brian Jones would become another unfortunate member of the 27 Club, a group of world-famous musicians and actors who have all sadly passed away, usually from drug and alcohol abuse, at the age of 27. Between 1969 and 1971, Jones would be followed by Jimi Hendrix, Jim Morrison, and Janis Joplin. Later, Kurt Cobain and Amy Winehouse, who lived in the Camden area of North London, two of modern music's biggest names, would also unfortunately join the list. With Duck Lane on your right, continue forward until you get to Wardour Street. Turn right and walk until you get to number 119. The addresses here have changed through time, so originally this was number 90 Wardour Street, home of the notorious Marquee Club. This is the former home of the Marquee Club, one of the world's most famous music venues from the 1960s to the 80s. Originally, the Marquee Club was on Oxford Street, and after its tenancy here, it was reopened in Charing Cross. But it was while here, on Wardour Street, that the Marquee became a legendary music venue known the world over. Everybody in the who's who of the rock and roll world has played here. Led Zeppelin, The Who, Jimi Hendrix, The Beatles, The Rolling Stones, Jethro Tull, Queen, The Stone Roses, The Pixies, Susie and the Banshees, The Cure, Metallica, who performed their first ever UK gig here, Iron Maiden, Def Leppard, The Police, Status Quo, Genesis, and even Prince. The Marquee Club has also hosted an important first and an iconic last. This is where the Rolling Stones played their first ever live show on the 12th of July, 1962. And this is also where David Bowie performed as Ziggy Stardust for the last time in October 1973. Now, as you face the building, look up Wardour Street to your left, and on the right-hand side you will see a pub called The Ship. This is where people would come to find out what gigs were on at the Marquee Club. And The Ship is probably the most traditional rock and roll pub left in Soho that hasn't lost its charm to quinoa and avocados. This is where the fans and the stars would come before and after shows, and occasionally artists would play intimate gigs here, and the long-serving staff will happily point out the places where Prince passed out or where Ike and Tina sat together. With number 90 on your right, walk back up Wardour Street. Walk until you get to Flaxman Court and The Ship, and then turn right. Where the path curves to the left, follow until you get to St. Anne's Court. Stop at number 17. This is the iconic Trident Studios. If you think back to our stop at Savile Row, where the Apple Studios were located, where the Let It Be album was partially recorded, you'd recall it's a posh area, filled mostly by high-end shops. If you were to go to Abbey Road in northwest London, you would find the Abbey Road Studios, right in the middle of a neighborhood, no pubs and no shops nearby. But here we're in the heart of London, and this is where Paul McCartney loved to be. You've got the Bricklayers Pub around the corner, Carnaby Street just a few minutes away, The Ship, the Marquee Club. This is right where it all happens. Paul's association with Trident Studios began benignly enough. He'd heard a version of the song, Those Were the Days, My Friend, by Mary Hopkin, which isn't a groundbreaking masterpiece, but Paul had a true musician's ear, and he commented on how great the sound quality of the recording was. He did some investigating to find out where it was recorded, and that's how he wound up here in the Trident Studios. You can imagine how excited he was. He'd found an excellent recording studio right in the area where he liked to party. From here, he could record, go to the pub, record some more, go back to the pub. You get the idea. So Paul brings the Beatles here for the next recording session, which happened to be recording of their legendary single, Hey Jude. The Beatles have always been trendsetters, and once word spread that this was where they were recording, Trident Studios became the most sought-after recording venue in the world. And Paul McCartney was not happy about that. So, what did he do? He started block booking the studios, a month at a time, paid entirely up front. I mean, he could afford it, right? This way he could come and go as he pleased, whenever it suited him. A few years on, after the Beatles had split, Trident Studios became the recording home of Queen, as well as their management company. In 1972, Queen hadn't yet had a smash hit, but they were recording their work in this iconic studio, and Freddie Mercury was playing music on the same piano McCartney had used in Hey Jude and Elton John had used in Your Song. Queen's next three albums, Queen 2, Sheer Heart Attack, and A Night at the Opera, were in large recorded here, including the piano pieces in the iconic record-breaking single, Bohemian Rhapsody. A list of songs and artists that put their voices onto track within this building is really like a list of the who's who of rock and pop history. Most of the Beatles' White Album, as well as Hey Jude, Elton John's Candle in the Wind and Your Song, Bowie's The Rise and Fall of Ziggy Stardust, three Queen albums, The Bee Gees, Carly Simon's You're So Vain, Frank Zappa, Genesis, James Taylor, Joe Cocker, Kiss, Lou Reed's Transformer, Peter Gabriel, The Rolling Stones' Get Your Ya-Ya's Out, Thin Lizzy, Tina Turner, T-Rex, Yes, Henry Nilsson's Without You, Dusty Springfield, Band ZX, Jeff Beck, and Rod Stewart. All here, in this tiny studio tucked away on a little alley in Soho that most people don't even know exists. With number 17 on your left, walk down St. Anne's Court and turn right onto Dean Street. Walk until you get to Bateman Street and turn left. Take the first right onto Frith Street and walk until you get to number 47. You are now outside Ronnie Scott's Jazz Club, one of the coolest and most legendary jazz clubs in the world, and it has been for about the past 50 years. Recently, it showcased work by unexpected artists such as Martha Reeves from Martha and the Vandellas, Marianne Faithfull, and even Jeff Goldblum, an accomplished pianist when he's not making films. But going back through the decades, from when musicians Ronnie Scott and Pete King opened this, their second venue, in 1965, these walls have heard the voices of some of the most iconic jazz and blues acts of all time. Miles Davis, Ella Fitzgerald, Amy Winehouse, The who performed the rock opera Tommy for the first time on stage here, Johnny Griffin, Lee Konitz, Ronnie Rollins, Sonny Stitt, Tubby Hayes, Dick Morrissey, Chet Baker, Cassandra Wilson, Prince, Katie Melua, Jamie Callum, Curtis Mayfield, and Jimi Hendrix. This club is also the site of one of rock music's legendary final performances. Eric Burdon, previously the frontman of the Animals, had put together a new band called War, and this new band was having their debut jam session here at Ronnie Scott's on the 15th of September 1970. Eric had asked Jimi Hendrix if he wanted to come down to play with them. Jimmy agreed. However, when he arrived, he was not allowed to play owing to his inebriated and drug-induced state. Eric asked him to come back the next night, which he did. And on the evening of the 16th of September 1970, Jimi Hendrix played his guitar in public for the last time. Within 48 hours, he was dead of a drug overdose at the age of 27. Before you move on, with your back to the club, look directly opposite and you will notice a blue plaque commemorating the fact that Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart once lived here. And, as a side note, next door above the bar Italia, coincidentally the subject of a song written by Jarvis Cocker and a popular haunt of the Gallagher brothers and members of Madness, as well as previously David Bowie and Iggy Pop, you will see a plaque for John Logie Baird, the inventor of the television. This really highlights the eclectic style and history of this vibrant London neighborhood. With Ronnie Scott's on your right, continue down Frith Street and take the first right onto Old Compton Street. As you walk down, you will pass Poppy's Fish and Chips at number 55, our favorite fish and chips in London. Continue walking until you get to Wardour Street and turn left. Continue down, cross Shaftesbury Avenue, and walk until you get to numbers 33 to 37 on your right. O'Neill's is a chain of Irish-themed pubs here in the UK, but this particular O'Neill's has had an incredibly unexpected musical history. In the 1950s and 60s, this was the Flamingo Club, an iconic venue which was the first in London to play West Indian music and was a hotspot for blues and jazz. In fact, Ronnie Scott and Tubby Hayes made up members of their resident band. And it was here that Georgie Fame recorded Night Train. There's another laundry list of acts that played here at the Flamingo Club. Billie Holiday, Stevie Wonder, Patti LaBelle, Dizzy Gillespie, Pink Floyd, Otis Redding, Rod Stewart, The Animals, The Moody Blues, The Rolling Stones, and Ella Fitzgerald, just to name a few. Not only did the club have an excellent array of performers, it was also one of the places to be seen in swinging London, and musicians like Hendrix and McCartney were often spotted here in the audience. After the Flamingo Club shut down, it reopened in the 1970s as the Whiskey A Go-Go and maintained its status as a celebrity hotspot. James Brown and Kool and the Gang performed here, and Robert De Niro and Jack Nicholson are both known to have been frequent visitors. Again, the club would transform in the 1980s, becoming the Wag Club, a Brit pop-focused creation. As the Wag Club, this venue would see performances and appearances by Madonna, Prince, LL Cool J, George Michael, Boy George, Keith Richards, and David Bowie, who filmed his Blue Jean video here. With your back to the venue, look into Chinatown towards Gerrard Street, where the large gate is. Surprisingly, this street was the location of the first ever rehearsals of Led Zeppelin. The exact address isn't known, as Led Zeppelin themselves can't even recall it. With O'Neill's to your right, walk down Wardour Street until you get to Swiss Court on your left. Take the left and walk until you get to Leicester Square. Stop by the statue of William Shakespeare in the center. Originally a gentrified square home to the wealthy, today Leicester Square is the heart of London's entertainment industry and the West End. In the theatres surrounding you now, some of the biggest and greatest names have performed. The Clash, the Sex Pistols, the Rolling Stones, Boy George with his premiere of Taboo, Julie Andrews in a debut performance at the age of 12, Diana Ross and the Supremes, Judy Garland, Petula Clark, The Carpenters, Eartha Kitt, Shirley Bassey, Cliff Richards, Stevie Wonder, Frank Sinatra, Sammy Davis Jr., Lena Horne, The Andrews Sisters, Tom Jones, Liza Minnelli, and even the Jackson Five. You are truly now standing in the heart of London's iconic, enduring musical legacy, surrounded by all the names and the voices of the past which still echo through this neighborhood today. If you've enjoyed a rock and roll tour with us and wish to take another self-guided tour, visit our website at www.freetoursbyfoot.com. There you will also find self-guided tours of Roman London, Westminster, Harry Potter, Jack the Ripper, and more. You will also find information on other audio tours that we offer, and also our full schedule. Free Tours by Foot offers pay-what-you-like walking tours on a daily basis here in London, and we'd love to have you join us. Simply book online. Thank you for touring with Free Tours by Foot today, and we hope you've enjoyed every step of your journey.